Next is an excerpt from a class recorded on July 30th, 2000 at the Dublin Preaching Center.
So, my talk this morning is going to be on two terms, optimism and pessimism, and I'll try to apply Krishna consciousness to these. Everybody knows what they mean, but I'm going to read some definitions from a new dictionary I got. In fact, you might think this is an odd topic for a lecture. Perhaps it began because I got a new dictionary. And I was looking through it for different things. I didn't have a dictionary for 20 years. And now words change very fast. This dictionary boasts that it changes words faster than others. And they also had a good definition of Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna, one, a religious sect based on Vedic scriptures founded in the U.S. in 1966. Two, a member of this sect from chanted phrase Hare Krishna, Hindu or Hindi, Hare Krishna, O Krishna. I can remember some years ago the word cult was used in a dictionary I had, and sect is much better. Optimism and pessimism. You can do optimism first. Oh, and also this dictionary says that it will give the most common usage first, and then go on to other usages. Sometimes dictionaries don't do that. They give you a very obscure meaning first. Optimism. One, a tendency to look on the more favorable side or to expect the most favorable outcome of events or conditions. That's the common meaning. Then two, the belief that good will ultimately triumph over evil and that virtue will be rewarded. And three, the doctrine that the existing world is the best of all possible worlds. So it gets quite philosophical toward the end of the definition, apart from what the man in the street says, although it's all pretty much the same. Becomes a stricter kind of definition and even a doctrine. Pessimism. One, the tendency to see only what is disadvantageous or gloomy, or to anticipate the worst outcome. Two, the doctrine that the existing world is the worst of all possible worlds, or that all things naturally tend toward evil. Three, the belief that the evil and pain in the world outweigh any goodness or happiness. So these are heavy meanings, and people line themselves up with different things, or perhaps somewhat in between. This phrase, the best of all possible worlds, was posited by a philosopher, Leibniz. And he was in the 1600s and 1700s, and he talked about cause and effect, and arrived at a conclusion that we live in the best of all possible worlds. So, his philosophy was attacked most notably by a writer and thinker named Voltaire. And when I was in college in the world literature class, we studied Voltaire's book Candide. And I think in the 1950s, it was also a musical comedy for a while. I remember a friend used to go around singing, "We live in this best of all possible worlds." So I'm going to talk a little bit about Candide. It's named after the main character in the book, who's a young man, and he lives in the family of royalty, although he himself doesn't come down in royalty, a little bit like Vidura lived in the family of Dhritarashtra. But he wasn't of that great character. In fact, he got in trouble and was caught having an affair with the princess of that family. So the baroness threw him out of the castle. Oh, wait, I wanted to tell you more before we kick him out. Also in this family, there was a philosopher. Just any great court, they have a sage. So the philosopher, he's the one who's... Voltaire makes him a mockery of Leibniz. So Master Pangloss, he's being described. And Candide was very... a good student of his. Candide listened to his instructions with all the simplicity natural to his age and disposition. Master Pangloss taught the metaphysico theologio cosmolo onigology. He could prove to admiration that there is no effect without a cause, and that in this best of all possible worlds, the baron's castle was the most magnificent of all castles, and my lady was the best of all possible baronesses. It is demonstrable, he said, that things cannot be otherwise than as they are. For as all things have been created for some end, they must necessarily be created for the best end. Observe, for instance, the nose is formed for spectacles. Therefore, we wear spectacles. The legs are visibly designed for stockings. Accordingly, we wear stockings. Stones were made to be hewn and to construct castles. Therefore, my lord has a magnificent castle. You see, this is a mockery. And whereas Leibniz, being used in his words, it could actually be a kind of implication that there is a deity. But Voltaire wants to attack that idea. If you're saying that this world we live in is the best of all possible world. Swine were intended to be eaten, therefore we eat pork all the year round. And they who assert that everything is right do not express themselves correctly. They should say, everything is best. So I told you already. The Candide was kicked out of the castle, and he had nowhere to go. He was wandering in the snow, and then some men of an army, the Bulgarian army, saw him, and they said to each other, we can use this fellow. Reminded me of, what's his name? Yeah. Well, Jadbarat, how he was captured and put into the army. So they go up to him, and they say, how tall are you? He says, I'm 5'5". Oh, that'll do. They say, have you heard of the emperor of Bulgaria? He said, no, I never heard of him. I said, well, here, let's drink to him. Is that all right? Yes, he said, I'll drink to him. They give him a drink, and then they say, all right, now you're a member of the army, and they put handcuffs on him. So this is his first encounter. I'm not going to tell you the whole book, but I'll tell you the first encounters in his best of all possible worlds. So he's in the army, and he had to learn how to walk, you know, march this way, that way, wheel about to the right, to the left, draw his rammer, return his rammer, present, fire, march, and then they gave him 30 blows with a cane. The next day he performed the exercise a little better, and they gave him 20 blows. Candide was struck with amazement, and he could not, for the soul of him, conceive how he had become a hero. They called him a hero when he did it without any blows. One fine spring morning, he took it into his head to take a walk, and he marched straight forward, conceiving it to be a privilege of the human species, as well as of the brute creation, to make use of their legs how and when they pleased. He had gone about 2 leagues when he was overtaken by 4 other heroes, 6 foot high, who bound him neck and heels and carried him to a dungeon. A court-martial set upon him, and he was asked which he liked better, to run the gauntlet 36 times or through the whole regiment, or to have his brains blown out with a dozen musket balls. So somehow or other he gets out of that, escapes, and again he's alone, and he runs into this man in a horrible condition. By some kind of disease, his nose is falling off and his teeth are coming out even when he tries to speak. And he begs of Candide, and Candide has a coin and he gives it to him. And then they talk, and it finds out that it's Pangloss, Dr. Pangloss, my philosophy, my guru. And Dr. Pangloss says, oh, it's you, Candide. So they're both in such a wretched state. So he asks Dr. Pangloss, what happened? Now, Pangloss says the whole castle has been looted by invaders. And so the baroness is gone, and I've been kicked out too. And so he asks, what about this disease that you have? So Dr. Pangloss hasn't given up his philosophy. And he said he admits to that affair he had with the a lady in the palace. And he says she was infected with an ailment and perhaps has died since. She received this present from a learned Franciscan who derived it from the fountainhead. He was indebted to it to an old countess who had it of a captain of horses, who had it from a marchioness, who had it of a page. The page had it of a Jesuit who during his novitiate had it in direct line from one of the fellow adventurers of Christopher Columbus. So then Candide says, oh, sage Pangloss, what a strange genealogy is this. Is the devil not the root of it? And then Pangloss says, not at all. It was a thing unavoidable, a necessary ingredient in the best of worlds. For if Columbus had not caught in an island in America this disease, which contaminates the source of generation and frequently impedes propagation itself, he goes on and on, says, we would not have either chocolate or something else, C-O-C-I-E-N-E-L. Any of the cooks know what that is? Cochineal? Yeah. So that's what he said. So they go through worse and worse adventures. And I'm just bringing it to the end of the story, which is kind of significant. They finally meet, he and his friend Pangloss, they meet a man with a small family who's living off his land, and they all work themselves. They don't depend on anybody. And in a sense, they also have nothing to do with trying to understand events, larger events of the world, but just keep to themselves. And Pangloss and their entourage, they decide that they want to live like that. And this is Voltaire's positive understanding of what a person can do in this horrible world, which in here they're described, the earthquake that just took place in Lisbon and 30,000 people died, and other things like that. How can you keep saying it's a good world or the best world? But they decide on this is what they're going to do and not try to be higher placed. These little society, one and all, this is his last words, entered into this laudable design and set themselves to exert their different talents. The little piece of ground yielded them a plentiful crop. The wife of Candide became an excellent hand at pastry work. Paquette embroidered. The old woman had taken care of the linen. There was none down to brother Girofle, but did some service. He was a good carpenter and became an honest man. Pangloss used to now and then say to Candide, there is a concatenation of all events in the best of possible worlds. For in short, had you not been kicked out of a fine castle for the love of Miss Cunegonde, had you not been put into the Inquisition, had you not traveled over America on foot, had you not run the baron through the body, and had you not lost all your sheep, which you brought from the good country of El Dorado, you would not have been here to eat preserved chitrons and pistachio nuts. And Candide says, excellently observed, said Candide, but we must cultivate our garden. And that's like he's almost humoring Pangloss now. And I took the trouble to read so much because that affirmation of what we can do in life, it could also be applied to life in ISKCON or our life in the material world as it is now in the 21st century, that you don't have any hope that by your actions that you can create a larger reform except the reform of yourself and the reform of, if you're a family person, the reform of your family, and you take activity to, he says, cultivate your garden. And I also think of with a hoe, rowing your own hoe. You plant and you eat what you plant. And there's no use philosophizing about what is the higher state of life, or what is the higher being's intention toward us. Well, it's an interesting, although very satirical, negative attitude of a philosophy that we live in the best of all possible worlds. Voltaire wasn't the only one who mocked this philosophy. There's another philosopher, Schopenhauer, came a little after this, and he's interesting because he was one of the first Western or German philosophers to read the Vedic literature. The Germans were first because they had the first Sanskrit scholars to translate the Vedas, and he read the Upanishads, especially like the Maya, the concept of Maya, that everything is illusion. And his philosophy was just the opposite, that we live in the worst of all possible worlds. So it was interesting that Vedic literature could be used to support that. I also wrote a little bit something about that in my readings in Vedic literature. I was explaining in the beginning, everything is concisely explained, that Vedic literature says that material life is full of suffering. There are threefold sufferings that come from either our own body, from other living entities, or from the demigods sending calamities like weather, which covers all of the miseries in Candide, by the way. And then we're into the fourfold miseries to each living entity, birth, death, disease, and old age. So when people first hear what Vedic knowledge is, they think it's very negative. On hearing this sweeping analysis of life in the material world, Albert Schweitzer termed the Vedic philosophy world and life negation. They think like that, that the highest philosophy of India is to merge into Brahman, and that everything is Maya, so you should get out of it. Everything is suffering, and salvation means to negate. But that means they haven't read further. They haven't read the positive side. But when we view the Vedas closely, we can discern that they teach quite the opposite. They propose that the purpose of human life is not to resign oneself to a temporary and miserable world, but to strive for permanent happiness. For people who follow the Vedic formula, life means an opportunity to attain victory over death. In the Vedic conception, a person negates life precisely when he identifies the illusory body with the self. I think we can generalize and say that although devotees are different in so many different ways that I'll try to touch on a little later, but to start with the generalization, anyone who aspires to be a devotee in Krishna consciousness is optimistic about spiritual facts of life and is pessimistic toward material life. And to the degree that you haven't realized those two things, is maybe lack of advancement. That in the name of being a devotee, you're not so happy, and you're very attracted to material life. That wouldn't be much of a devotee. I remember taking a walk with Prabhupada when it was finished, and like the last thing he said was that if you have any idea that material life is happy, you cannot become Krishna conscious. And another time he said, aside from what he's written in his books, he said, there is no happiness in this material world at all, except but if there is any, it's in America. He said that when the plane was going to the west coast of America. But by the same token, he said, when people said, well, you say that people, they act badly and they get bad karma, but here in America we have very good karma. We said we supposedly act bad. And Prabhupada said, just wait. So let's talk a little bit about this optimism and pessimism. But we're optimistic. I remember a personal memory of feeling so happy about that and expressing it to a godbrother before either of us had even gotten initiation. It was a time that Prabhupada had been invited up to the country ashram of Dr. Mishra. It's called Ananda Ashram. And he told us that we were going to go there, but I arrived a little late at 26 Second Avenue, and this other young man, Bruce, he was there late too, and Prabhupada had gone, so he missed the ride. But then somehow somebody else turned up, and he had a vehicle, a Jeep or something. And so we jumped in the back and off we went. And we were glad that we weren't going to be able to see Swamiji. But then we began talking to each other as young man to young man without it having to be official or having to fulfill some role or something that you expected to have a certain belief. But we're saying, isn't this great? Isn't this far out? This self is eternal. When we die, we don't really die, as what Swami is teaching. So everyone has some feeling like that when they started to grasp Krishna consciousness and wanted to accept it, that this is very optimistic, that when I die, I don't die. And I'll either take another body and for my activity in Krishna consciousness, I've made gain in this human life for doing that, or I may go to Krishna. So a devotee is jolly, as Prabhupada would say, and if you're not feeling that, then you're not Krishna conscious. I was going to bring another book to read from, but maybe Krishna wants me to speak without reading from books. I have a wonderful expression of optimism in the Chaitanya Bhagavat. When Lord Chaitanya was having his kirtans and revealing himself as the Supreme Person, after all those years of cheating everyone and behaving like an arrogant scholar, he was finally revealing himself as the Supreme Lord at Srivas Thakur's house, having kirtans, and relating especially to each different individual. So calling them up and revealing to them what their rasa was with Krishna and with what form, and asking what boon they wanted. But one person he wasn't calling up, a very prominent person, was Mukunda. Mukunda was a great singer, and his singing used to make everyone ecstatic. So he was hiding within the house, and it was getting obvious that he wasn't being called. So the devotee said, "My Lord, are you going to call on Mukunda?" He said, "Mukunda, don't even mention his name. He's a good for nothing. He's just like a chameleon. Whoever he's with, he is like them. If he associates with the Mayavadis, he becomes like them. If he comes here, he'll act like a devotee. So sometimes, in effect, he offers me a rose, and sometimes he hits me with a malice, with a hammer." All the other devotees were really shocked to hear that. But they knew Mukunda was not like that. He was a true Vaishnava. So they tried again. He said, "No, I will not see Mukunda in a million lives." So then Mukunda jumped out of hiding, and he held up his hands with happiness, and he said, "I will, I will." He was hanging on that one part of the sentence, "I will." He said, "I will not see him for a million years, but I will." And then Lord Chaitanya laughed and accepted him right away. But that's optimism, that when you see the silver lining in something, instead of seeing it the other way, well, who knows what's going to happen, if it's really going to happen or not. Where am I going to be in a million years anyway? So he was optimistic. Pessimistic. so many sections in the Bhagavatam hammer away at this and tear away at this conception that you can be happy in the material world. I just happen to be reading this in my own daily reading, The Forest of Enjoyment, which Advarad is teaching King Rahugana. So here are some verses. Sometimes conditioned souls exchange money, but in due course of time, enmity arises because of cheating. Although there may be a tiny profit, the conditioned souls cease to be friends and become enemies. Isn't it true? If there's little money involved in exchange, so-called friends become enemies, even if they're devotees. Yeah, Prabhupada says in the purport, unless one is firmly fixed in the regular principles, one may perform mischievous acts, even if one is a member of the Krishna consciousness movement. And Jad Bharat says, sometimes having no money, the conditioned soul does not get sufficient accommodations. Sometimes he doesn't even have a place to sit, nor does he have other necessities. In other words, he falls into scarcity, and at that time, when he is unable to secure the necessities by fair means, he decides to steal the property of others. When he cannot get the things he wants, he receives insults from others and becomes very morose. Next verse. Although people may be enemies, in order to fulfill their desires again and again, they sometimes get married. That's strange. I would think at the time they were married, they didn't think they were your enemies. It might come out later. But here it speaks of enemies getting married. Unfortunately, these marriages do not last very long, and the people involved are separated again by divorce or other means. And in the purport, Prabhupada says, due to cheating propensity, both parties remain envious. Even in Krishna consciousness, separation and enmity take place due to the prominence of material propensities. The conclusion is that no one can be happy in material life. One must take to Krishna consciousness. There's also a psychological difference among different devotees. Just like some devotees physically are big and some are not big. And we have different sexes and so forth. So there may be psychological difference that some devotees have a somewhat optimistic attitude and not as it's expressed in their Krishna consciousness. And another devotee may be more pessimistic, and not necessarily that because he is that way, he's less advanced. He may, in other words, you may use that trait to serve Krishna, or you have to use it because somehow that's just your psychophysical nature. I remember very early memories. Prabhupada was talking about something. There was only one center in New York before he left. And he was speaking of how the movement was going to spread. And he said, Ray Rama says he's going to get land in Alaska. Somehow that topic came up. And I made fun of it. So I guess I brought it up first. Because Prabhupada, then he imitated my tone of voice. I said it pessimistically and skeptical. Oh, and listen to this, Ray Rama is going to get land in Alaska. So, and then Prabhupada said it the way I said it right after that. And I got kind of shocked. What I was stating was not necessarily a fact, but an attitude. But that might be you. Let me have some questions and answers. I'd like you to express some of this. Are there some questions for me about optimism and pessimism? Yeah.
That comment that Prabhupada made that if you're attracted to the material, oh, there's no enjoyment in the material world, and until you realize that, you can't be Krishna conscious. And then he said, and then he said, if there is any enjoyment, it's in America. So that's Prabhupada saying anyway, he's making that comment. So for someone like myself, it's like, yeah, I see there's enjoyment in America, but also in Ireland too, you know. That, you know, I can't, that there is kind of, it seems there's some enjoyment there. But then you made a comment to say that if a devotee is attracted to sense gratification, that then they're not much of a devotee, you know, because that attraction's there. So I was just wondering that, so we're talking about pessimism and optimism, that the optimistic thing is to be really, as you said, jolly. A devotee's jolly because he understands that he's the eternal spirit soul, his relationship to Krishna, it's going to be really blissful when he goes back to Krishna. Should be blissful now as well. But then we do have this attraction, I have this attraction for then material enjoyment, sense gratification. But I've seen it myself personally, and also with others when you talk to different people, that you may be attracted to material life, and you may even engage in some aspects of material or things that aren't essential for your spiritual life, and something like that. But generally when a devotee does that, they're actually pessimistic. They can't actually enjoy it in the same way as Redman talking to me at the party, as though I can enjoy it fully because I'm a non-devotee and I don't suffer mentally if I'm in education center. But it's rare that you find a devotee, at least is my experience, who engages in some aspect of material.
Who's become ruined by it.
They may enjoy it a little bit, you know, but they might just can't because they know Krishna, they know the philosophy, you know, and it just ends up making them more miserable, you know. So that pessimism seems to be a positive thing, because if they did actually engage in material life and they weren't pessimistic about it, they didn't get depressed about it, then there'd be no springboard or no thing to sort of push them back towards Krishna consciousness, you know.
It's so revolutionary. I don't know about other movements, but it's the Krishna consciousness movement. Prabhupada in one purport, when all those sons, Hariyasvas, of Daksha were all converted by Narada Muni, Daksha got angry, and Prabhupada said that in the Krishna consciousness movement we see that even if our students get married, there are so many no's and do's and don'ts that the parents, they don't think that this doesn't make them happy that their daughters and sons got married in Krishna consciousness. It's just more renunciation. So that's part of the revolutionary nature of Krishna consciousness. And I was just thinking of a particular thing to remark on what you were saying. Not only the devotee, he can't enjoy the material life, but it may be that his offspring, or the students, the young students who went to the schools of Krishna consciousness, they feel they were ruined for enjoying material life. And that becomes the cause of a court case or something, aside from actual reasons for court case. I've seen things like, we were made to bathe in the Ganges every day, and we were made to not use toilet paper, or we had to chant Hare Krishna. What about that? We sort of took it for granted that we joined by free will, but is it a free will thing for every individual? It's a very hard question to answer. Since as a grihasta, all that you're going through for raising the children is with some heart's desire to see them turn out Krishna consciousness. So that's just like another version of heartbreaker in the material world. The heartbreaker for the spiritual master is when the disciples turn against him, and the same version for the parents is if the children don't want the spiritual life that they were given. Krishna may give unique twists for us to show that we have nothing but him to turn to. So that we get our sights adjusted, you know, what I should be optimistic about, what I should be pessimistic about. But if what you say is true, then it's good. We've gone past the point of no return.